hide the bruises rather than conceal them, and a feeling of great uneasiness overtakes him. He hears Rödl swinging the hose, the smack of it across Frederick's upflung palms. He hears the voices of the boys in his Kameradschaften back in Solverein sing, "Live faithfully, fight bravely, and die laughing." The bistro is so overcrowded. Everyone's mouths move too quickly. The woman talking to Frederick's mother is wearing a nauseating quantity of perfume, and in the watery light it seems suddenly as if the scarf trailing from the dancing girl's neck is a noose. Frederick says, "Are you all right?" "Fine. It's delicious." But Werner feels something inside him screw tighter. Tighter. On the way home, Frederick and his mother walk ahead. She loops her slender arm through his and talks to him in a low voice. "Freddy this, Freddy that." The street is empty, the windows dead, the electric signs switched off, innumerable shops, millions sleeping in beds around them. And yet where are they all? As they reach Frederick's block, a woman in a dress, leaning against a building, bends over and vomits on the sidewalk. In the townhouse, Frederick pulls on pajamas made of jelly-green silk and folds his glasses on the nightstand and climbs barefoot into his brass childhood bed. Werner gets into a trundle bed that Frederick's mother has apologized for 3 separate times, although its mattress is more comfortable than any he has slept on in his life. The building falls quiet. Model automobiles glimmer on Frederick's shelves. "Do you ever wish," whispers Werner, "that you didn't have to go back? Father needs me to be at Schulpforte. Mother, too. It doesn't matter what I want." "Of course it matters. I want to be an engineer. And you want to study birds. Be like that American painter in the swamps. Why else do any of this if not to become who we want to be?" A stillness in the room. Out there in the trees, beyond Frederick's window, hangs an alien light. "Your problem, Werner," says Frederick, "is that you still believe you own your life." When Werner wakes, it's well past dawn. His head aches and his eyeballs feel heavy. Frederick is already dressed, wearing trousers, an iron shirt, and a necktie, kneeling against the window with his nose against the glass. "Gray wagtail," he points. Werner looks past him into the naked lindens. "Doesn't look like much, does he?" murmurs Frederick. "Hardly a couple of ounces of feathers and bones. But that bird can fly to Africa and back, powered by bugs and worms and desire." The wagtail hops from twig to twig. Werner rubs his aching eyes. "It's just a bird." 10,000 years ago, whispers Frederick, "they came through here in the millions. When this place was a garden, one endless garden, from end to end."
He is not coming back. Marie-Laure wakes and thinks she hears the shuffle of Papa's shoes, the clink of his keyring. 4th floor, 5th floor, 6th. His fingers brush the doorknob. His body radiates a faint but palpable heat in the chair beside her. His little tools rasp across wood. He smells of glue and sandpaper and Galois Bleu. But it is only the house groaning, the sea throwing foam against rocks, deceits of the mind. On the 20th morning, without any word from her father, Marie-Laure does not get out of bed. She no longer cares that her great-uncle put on an ancient necktie and stood by the front door on 2 separate occasions and whispered weird rhymes to himself. "A la pomme de terre, je suis par terre, au haricot, je suis dans l'eau." Trying and failing to summon the courage to go out. She no longer begs Madame Manic to take her to the train station, to write another letter, to spend another futile afternoon at the prefecture trying to petition occupation authorities to locate her father. She becomes unreachable, sullen. She does not bathe, she does not warm herself by the kitchen fire, ceases to ask if she can go outdoors. She hardly eats. "The museum says they're searching, child," whispers Madame Manic. But when she tries to press her lips to Marie-Laure's forehead, the girl jerks backward as if burned. The museum replies to Etienne's appeals. They report that Marie-Laure's father never arrived.
"Never arrived?" says Etienne aloud.
This becomes the question that drags its teeth through Marie-Laure's mind. Why didn't he make it to Paris? If he couldn't, why didn't he return to Saint-Malo? "I will never leave you, not in a million years." She wants only to go home, to stand in their four-room flat and hear the chestnut tree rustle outside her window, hear the cheese seller raise his awning, feel her father's fingers close around hers. If only she had begged him to stay. Now everything in the house scares her, the creaking stairs, shuttered windows, empty rooms, the clutter and silence. Etienne tries performing silly experiments to cheer her, a vinegar volcano, a tornado in a bottle. "Can you hear it, Marie, spinning in there?" She does not feign interest. Madame Manic brings her omelets, cassoulet, brochette of fish, fabricating miracles out of ration tickets and the dregs of her cupboards, but Marie-Laure refuses to eat. "Like a snail," she overhears Etienne say outside her door, "curled up so tight in there." But she is angry. At Etienne for doing so little, at Madame Manic for doing so much, at her father for not being here to help her understand his absence, at her eyes for failing her, at everything and everyone. Who knew love could kill you? She spends hours kneeling by herself on the sixth floor with the window open and the sea hurling Arctic air into the room, her fingers on the model of Saint-Malo slowly going numb. South to the gate of Dinan, west to the Plage de Mol, back to the Rue Vaubrel. Every second Etienne's house grows colder. Every second it feels as if her father slips farther away. Prisoner. One February morning, the cadets are roused from their beds at 2 a.m. and driven out into the glitter. In the center of the quadrangle, torches burn. Keg-chested Bastian waddles out with his bare legs showing beneath his coat. Frank Folkheimer emerges from the shadows, dragging a tattered and skeletal man in mismatched shoes. Folkheimer sets him down beside the commandant, where a stake has been driven into the snow. Methodically, Folkheimer ties the man's torso to the stake. A vault of stars hangs overhead. The collective breath of the cadets mingles slowly, nightmarishly above the courtyard. Folkheimer retreats. The commandant paces. "You boys would not believe what a creature this is. What a foul beast. A centaur. An Untermensch." Everyone cranes to see. The prisoner's ankles are cuffed and his arms bound from wrists to forearms. His thin shirt is split at the seams and he gazes into some middle distance with hypothermic slackness. He looks Polish. Russian, maybe. Despite his fetters, he manages to sway lightly back and forth. Bastian says, "This man escaped from a work camp, tried to violate a farmhouse and steal a liter of fresh milk. He was stopped before he could do something more nefarious." He gestures vaguely beyond the walls. "This barbarian would tear out your throats in a second if we let him." Since the visit to Berlin, a great dread has been blooming inside Werner's chest. It came gradually, as slow-moving as the sun's passage across the sky, but now he finds himself writing letters to Jutta in which he must skirt the truth, must contend that everything is fine when things do not feel fine. He descends into dreams in which Frederick's mother mutates into a leering, small-mouthed demon and lowers Dr. Hauptmann's triangles over his head. A thousand frozen stars preside over the quad. The cold is invasive, mindless. This look, Bastion says, and flourishes his fat hand. The way he's got nothing left. A German soldier never reaches this point. There's a name for this look. It's called circling the drain. The boys try not to shiver. The prisoner blinks down at the scene as if from a very high perch. Folkheimer returns carrying a clattering raft of buckets. Two other seniors uncoil a water hose across the quadrangle. Bastion explains. First the instructors. Then upperclassmen. Everyone will file past and soak the prisoner with a bucket of water. Every man in the school. They start. One by one, each instructor takes a bucket from Folkheimer and flings its contents at the prisoner a few feet away. Cheers rise into the frozen night. At the first two or three dousings, the prisoner comes awake, rocking back on his heels. Vertical creases appear between his eyes. He looks like someone trying to remember something vital. Among the instructors in their dark capes, Dr. Hauptmann goes past, his gloved fingers pinching his collar around his throat. Hauptmann accepts his bucket and throws a sheet of water and doesn't linger to watch it land. The water keeps coming. The prisoner's face empties. He slumps over the ropes propping him up, and his torso slides down the stake, and every now and then Folkheimer comes out of the shadows, looming fantastically huge, and the prisoner straightens again. The upperclassmen vanish inside the castle. The buckets make a muted, frozen clanking as they are refilled. The 16-year-olds finish. The 15-year-olds finish. The cheers lose their gusto and a pure longing to flee floods Werner. Run. Run. Three boys until his turn. Two boys. Werner tries to float images in front of his eyes, but the only ones that come are wretched. The hauling machine above Pit 9. The hunched miners walking as if they dragged the weight of enormous chains. The boy from the entrance exams trembling before he fell. Everyone trapped in their roles. Orphans, cadets, Frederick, Folkheimer, the old Jewess who lives upstairs. Even Jutta. When his turn arrives, Werner throws the water like all the others, and the splash hits the prisoner in the chest, and a perfunctory cheer rises. He joins the cadets waiting to be released. Wet boots, wet cuffs. His hands have become so numb they do not seem like his own. Five boys later, it is Frederick's turn. Frederick, who clearly cannot see well without his glasses, who has not been cheering when each bucket full of water finds its mark, who is frowning at the prisoner as though he recognizes something there. And Werner knows what Frederick is going to do. Frederick has to be nudged forward by the boy behind him. The upperclassman hands him a bucket and Frederick pours it out on the ground. Bastion steps forward. His face flares scarlet in the cold. Give him another. Again, Frederick sloshes it onto the ice at his feet. He says in a small voice, "He's already finished, sir." The upperclassman hands over a third pail. "Throw it," commands Bastion. The night steams. The stars burn. The prisoner sways. The boys watch. The commandant tilts his head. Frederick pours the water onto the ground. "I will not." Plage de Mol. Marie-Laure's father has been missing without word for 29 days. She wakes to Madame Manick's blocky pumps climbing to the third floor, the fourth, the fifth. Etienne's voice on the landing outside his study. "Don't."
"He won't know."
"She is my responsibility." Some unexpected steel emerges in Madame Manick's voice. "I cannot stand by one moment longer." She climbs the last flight. Marie-Laure's door creaks open, the old woman crosses the floor and places her heavy boned hand on Marie-Laure's forehead. You're awake? Marilor rolls herself into the corner and speaks through linens.
Yes, madame.
I'm taking you out. Bring your cane. Marilor dresses herself. Madame Manic meets her at the bottom of the stairs with a heel of bread. She ties a scarf over Marilor's head, buttons her coat all the way to the collar, and opens the front door. Morning in late February, and the air smells rainy and calm. Marilor hesitates, listening. Her heart beats 2, 4, 6, 8. Hardly anyone is out yet, dear, whispers Madame Manic. And we are doing nothing wrong. The gate creaks. One step down, now straight on. That's it. The cobbled street presses up irregularly against Marilor's shoes. The tip of her cane catches, vibrates, catches again. A light rain falls on rooftops, trickles through runnels, beads up on her scarf. Sound ricochets between high houses. She feels as she did in her first hour here, as if she has stepped into a maze. Far above them, someone shakes a duster out a window. A cat mews. What terrors gnash their teeth out here? What was Papa so anxious to protect her from? They make one turn, then a second, and then Madame Manic steers her left where Marilor does not expect her to, where the city walls, furred with moss, have been scrolling along unbroken, and they're stepping through a gateway. Madame? They pass out of the city. Stairs here. Mind yourself. One down, two. There you are. Easy as cake. The ocean. The ocean. Right in front of her. So close all this time. It sucks and booms and splashes and rumbles. It shifts and dilates and falls over itself. The labyrinth of Saint-Malo has opened onto a portal of sound larger than anything she has ever experienced. Larger than the Jardin des Plantes, larger than the Seine, larger than the grandest galleries of the museum. She did not imagine it properly. She did not comprehend the scale. When she raises her face to the sky, she can feel the thousand tiny spines of raindrops melt onto her cheeks, her forehead. She hears Madame Manic's raspy breathing, and the deep sounding of the sea among the rocks, and the calls of someone down the beach echoing off the high walls. In her mind, she can hear her father polishing locks, Dr. Geffard walking along the rows of his drawers. Why didn't they tell her it would be like this? That's Monsieur Radom calling to his dog, says Madame Manic. Nothing to worry about. Here's my arm. Sit down and take off your shoes. Roll up your coat sleeves. Marilor does as she is told. Are they watching? The Boche? So what if they are? An old woman and a girl? I'll tell them we're digging clams. What can they do? Uncle says they've buried bombs in the beaches. Don't you worry about that. He is frightened of an ant. He says the moon pulls the ocean back.
The moon?
Sometimes the sun pulls too. He says that around the islands, the tides make funnels that can swallow boats whole. We aren't going anywhere near there, dear. We're just on the beach. Marilor unwinds her scarf and Madame Manic takes it. Briny, weedy, pewter-colored air slips down her collar.
Madame?
Yes?
What do I do?
Just walk. She walks. Now there are cold, round pebbles beneath her feet. Now crackling weeds. Now something smoother, wet, unwrinkled sand. She bends and spreads her fingers. It's like cold silk. Cold, sumptuous silk onto which the sea has laid offerings. Pebbles, shells, barnacles. Tiny slips of wrack. Her fingers dig and reach. The drops of rain touch the back of her neck, the backs of her hands, The sand pulls the heat from her fingertips, from the soles of her feet. A months-old knot inside Marie-Laure begins to loosen. She moves along the tide line, almost crawling at first, and imagines the beach stretching off in either direction, ringing the promontory, embracing the outer islands, the whole filigreed tracery of the Breton coastline with its wild capes and crumbling batteries and vine-choked ruins. She imagines the walled city behind her, its soaring ramparts, its puzzle of streets. All of it suddenly as small as Papa's model. But what surrounds the model is not something her father conveyed to her. What's beyond the model is the most compelling thing. A flock of gulls squalls overhead. Each of the 100,000 tiny grains of sand in her fists grinds against its neighbor. She feels her father pick her up and spin her around 3 times. No occupation soldier comes to arrest them. No one even speaks to them. In 3 hours, Marie-Laure's numb fingers discover a stranded jellyfish, an encrusted buoy, and 1,000 polished stones. She wades to her knees and soaks the hem of her dress. When Madame Manic finally leads her, damp and dazzled, back to the Rue Vauborel, Marie-Laure climbs all 5 flights and raps on the door of Etienne's study and stands before him, wet sand stuck all over her face. "You were gone a long time," he murmurs. "I worried." "Here, uncle." From her pockets, she brings up shells. Barnacles, cowries, 13 lumps of quartz gritty with sand. "I brought you this, and this, and this, and this." Lapidary. In 3 months, Sergeant Major von Rumpel has traveled to Berlin and Stuttgart. He has assessed the value of 100 confiscated rings, 12 diamond bracelets, a Latvian cigarette case in which a lozenge of blue topaz twinkled. Now, back in Paris, he has slept at the Grand Hotel for a week and sent forth his queries like birds. Every night the moment returns to him, when he clasped that pear-shaped diamond between his thumb and forefinger, made huge by the lens of his loupe, and believed he held the 133-carat sea of flames. He stared into the stone's ice-blue interior, where miniature mountain ranges seemed to send back fire, crimsons and corals and violets, polygons of color twinkling and coruscating as he rotated it. And he almost convinced himself that the stories were true, that centuries ago a sultan's son wore a crown that blinded visitors, that the keeper of the diamond could never die, that the fabled stone had caromed down through the pegs of history and dropped into his palm. There was joy in that moment, triumph, but an unexpected fear mixed with it. The stone looked like something enchanted, not meant for human eyes, an object that, once looked at, could never be forgotten. But eventually reason won out. The joints of the diamond's facets were not quite as sharp as they should have been, the girdle just slightly waxy. More telling, the stone betrayed no delicate cracks, no pinpoints, not a single inclusion. A real diamond, his father used to say, is never entirely free of inclusions. A real diamond is never perfect. Had he expected it to be real? To be kept precisely where he wished it would be? To win such a victory in a single day? Of course not. One might think von Rumpel would be frustrated, but he is not. On the contrary, he feels quite hopeful. The museum would never have commissioned such a high-quality fake if they did not possess the real thing somewhere. Over the past weeks in Paris, in the hours between other tasks, he has narrowed a list of 7 lapidaries to 3, then to 1. A half-Algerian named DuPont, who came of age cutting opal. It appears DuPont was making money before the war by faceting spinels into false diamonds for dowagers and baronesses, also for museums. One February night, Von Rumpel lets himself into DuPont's fastidious shop not far from Sacré-Cœur. He examines a copy of Streeter's Precious Stones and Gems, drawings of cleavage panes, trigonometric charts used for faceting. When he finds several painstaking iterations of a mold that match exactly the size and pear-cut shape of the stone in the vault at the museum, he knows he has his man. At Von Rumpel's request, DuPont is furnished with forged food ration tickets. Now Von Rumpel waits. He prepares his questions. Did you make other replicas? How many? Do you know who has them now? On the last day of February 1941, a dapper little Gestapo man comes to him with the news that the unwitting DuPont has tried to use the forged tickets. He has been arrested. Kinderleicht. Child's play. It's an attractive and drizzly winter's night. Scraps of melting snow shored up against the edges of the Place de la Concorde. The city looking ghostly, its windows jeweled with raindrops. A close-cropped corporal checks Von Rumpel's identification and points him not to a cell, but to a high-ceilinged third-story office where a typist sits behind a desk. On the wall behind her, a painted wisteria vine frays into a tangled modernist spray of colors that makes Von Rumpel uneasy. DuPont is cuffed to a cheap dining chair in the center of the room. His face has the color and polish of tropical wood. Von Rumpel expected a melange of fear and indignation and hunger, but DuPont sits upright. One of the lenses of his eyeglasses is already fractured, but otherwise he looks well enough. The typist twists her cigarette into an ashtray, a bright red smear of lipstick on its butt. The ashtray is full. 50 stubs squashed in there, limbless, somehow gory. "You can go," says Von Rumpel, nodding at her, and levels his attention on the lapidary.
"He cannot speak German, sir."
"We will be fine," he says in French. "Shut the door, please." DuPont looks up, some gland within him leeching courage into his blood. Von Rumpel does not have to force the smile. It comes easily enough. He hopes for names, but all he needs is a number.
Dearest Marie-Laure, we are in Germany now, and it's fine. I've managed to find an angel who will try to get this to you. The winter firs and alders are very beautiful here. And you are not going to believe this, but you will have to trust me. They serve us wonderful food. First class, quail and duck and stewed rabbit, chicken legs and potatoes fried with bacon and apricot tarts. Boiled beef with carrots, coq au vin on rice, plum tarts, fruits and crème glacée, as much as we can eat. I so look forward to the meals. Be polite to your uncle and madame, too. Thank them for reading this to you, and know that I am always with you, that I am right beside you. Your papa.
Entropy. For a week, the dead prisoner remains strapped to the stake in the courtyard, his flesh frozen gray. Boys stop and ask the corpse directions. Someone dresses him in a cartridge belt and helmet. After several days, a pair of crows take to standing on his shoulder, chiseling away with their beaks, and eventually the custodian comes out with 2 third-year boys, and they hack the corpse's feet out of the ice with a maul and tip him into a cart and roll him away. 3 times in 9 days, Frederick is chosen as the weakest in field exercises. Bastian walks out farther than ever and counts more quickly than ever, so that Frederick has to run 400 or 500 yards, often through deep snow. And the boys race after him as if their lives depend on it. Each time he is caught, each time he is drubbed while Bastian looks on, each time Werner does nothing to stop it. Frederick lasts 7 blows before falling, then 6, then 3. He never cries out and never asks to leave, and this in particular seems to make the Commandant quake with homicidal frustration. Frederick's dreaminess, his otherness, it's on him like a scent, and everyone can smell it. Werner tries to lose himself in his work in Hauptmann's lab. He has constructed a prototype of their transceiver and tests fuses and valves and handsets and plugs. But even in those late hours, it is as if the sky has dimmed and the school becomes a darker, ever more diabolical place. His stomach bothers him. He gets diarrhea. He wakes in distant quarters of the night and sees Frederick in his bedroom in Berlin, wearing his eyeglasses and necktie, freeing trapped birds from the pages of a massive book. "You're a smart boy. You'll do well." One evening, when Hauptmann is down the hall in his office, Werner glances over at imperious, sleepy Folkheimer in the corner and says, "That prisoner." Folkheimer blinks, stone turning to flesh. "They do that every year." He takes off his cap and runs one hand over the dense stubble of his hair. "They say he's a Pole, a Red, a Cossack. He stole liquor or kerosene or money. Every year it's the same." Under the seams of the hour, boys struggle in a dozen different arenas. 400 children crawling along the edge of a razor. "Always the same phrase, too," Folkheimer adds, "circling the drain." But was it decent to leave him out there like that? Even after he was dead? "Decency does not matter to them." Then Hauptmann's crisp boot heels come clicking into the room, and Folkheimer leans back into the corner, and his eye sockets refill with shadow, and Werner does not have the chance to ask him which "them" he means. Boys leave dead mice in Frederick's boots. They call him a poof, blowjob, countless other juvenile sobriquets. Twice a fifth year takes Frederick's field glasses and smears the lenses with excrement. Werner tells himself that he tries. Every night he polishes Frederick's boots for him until they shine a foot deep. One less reason for a bunkmaster or a bastion or an upperclassman to jump on him. Sunday mornings in the refectory, they sit quietly in a sunbeam and Werner helps him with his schoolwork. Frederick whispers that in the spring, he hopes to find skylark nests in the grasses outside the school walls. Once he lifts his pencil and stares into space and says, "Lesser spotted woodpecker." And Werner hears a bird's distant thrumming travel across the grounds and through the wall. In technical sciences, Dr. Hauptmann introduces the laws of thermodynamics. Entropy. Who can say what it is? The boys hunch over their desks. No one raises a hand. Hauptmann stalks the rows. Werner tries not to twitch a single muscle. Fennig. Entropy is the degree of randomness or disorder in a system, doctor. His eyes fix on Werner's for a heartbeat, a glance both warm and chilling. Disorder. You hear the commandant say it. You hear your bunkmasters say it. There must be order. Life is chaos, gentlemen, and what we represent is an ordering to that chaos. Even down to the genes, we are ordering the evolution of the species, winnowing out the inferior, the unruly, the chaff. This is the great project of the Reich, the greatest project human beings have ever embarked upon. Hauptmann writes on the blackboard. The cadets inscribe the words into their composition books. The entropy of a closed system never decreases. Every process must, by law, decay. The Rounds. Although Etienne continues to offer objections, Madame Manic walks Marie-Laure to the beach every morning. The girl knots her shoes herself, feels her way down the stairwell, and waits in the foyer with her cane in her fist while Madame Manic finishes up in the kitchen. "I can find my own way," Marie-Laure says the fifth time they step out. "You don't have to lead." 22 paces to the intersection with the Rue d'Estrée. 40 more to the little gate. 9 steps down and she's on the sand, and the 20,000 sounds of the ocean engulf her. She collects pine cones dropped by trees who knows how far away. Thick hanks of rope, slick globules of stranded polyps. Once, a drowned sparrow. Her greatest pleasure is to walk to the north end of the beach at low tide and squat below an island that Madame Manic calls Le Grand Bay and let her fingers whisk around in the tide pools. Only then, with her toes and fingers in the cold sea, does her mind seem to fully leave her father. Only then does she stop wondering how much of his letter was true, when he'll write again, why he has been imprisoned. She simply listens, hears, breathes. Her bedroom fills with pebbles, sea glass, shells, 40 scallops along the windowsill, 61 whelks along the top of the armoire. She arranges them by species whenever she can, then by size. Smallest on the left, largest on the right. She fills jars, pails, trays. The room assumes the smell of the sea. Most mornings after the beach, she makes the rounds with Madame Manic, going to the vegetable market, occasionally to the butcher's, then delivering food to whichever neighbors Madame Manic decides are most in need. They climb an echoing stairwell, rap on a door. An old woman invites them in, asks for news, insists all three of them drink a thimbleful of sherry. Madame Manic's energy, Marie-Laure is learning, is extraordinary. She burgeons, shoots off stalks, wakes early, works late, concocts bisques without a drop of cream, loaves with less than a cup of flour. They clomp together through the narrow streets, Marie-Laure's hand on the back of Madame's apron, following the odors of her stews and cakes. In such moments, Madame seems like a great moving wall of rose bushes, thorny and fragrant and crackling with bees. Still warm bread to an ancient widow named Madame Blanchard. Soup to Monsieur Saget. Slowly, Marie-Laure's brain becomes a three-dimensional map in which exist glowing landmarks. A thick plane tree in the Place aux Herbes. 9 potted topiaries outside the Hotel Continental. 6 stairs up a passageway called the Rue de Connétable. Several days a week, Madame brings food to crazy Harold Bazin, a veteran of the Great War who sleeps in an alcove behind the library in sun or snow, who lost his nose, left ear, and eye to shellfire, who wears an enameled copper mask over half his face. Harold Bazin loves to talk about the walls and warlocks and pirates of Saint-Malo. Over the centuries, he tells Marie-Laure, the city ramparts have kept out bloodthirsty marauders, Romans, Celts, Norsemen, some say sea monsters. For 1,300 years, he says, the walls kept out bloodthirsty English sailors who would park their ships offshore and launch flaming projectiles at the houses, who would try to burn everything and starve everybody, who would stop at nothing to kill them all. The mothers of Saint-Malo, he says, used to tell their children, sit up straight, mind your manners, or an Englishman will come in the night and cut your throat. Harold, please, says Madame Manic, you'll frighten her. In March, Etienne turns 60, and Madame Manic stews little clams, palourd, with shallots and serves them alongside mushrooms and quarters of 2 hard-boiled eggs, the only 2 eggs, she reports, she could find in the city. Etienne talks in his soft voice about the eruption of Krakatoa. How, in all of his earliest memories, ash from the East Indies turned the sunsets over Saint-Malo blood red, big veins of crimson glowing above the sea every evening, and to Marie-Laure, her pockets lined with sand, her face aglow from the wind, the occupation seems, for a moment, 1,000 miles away. She misses Papa. Paris, Dr. Geffard, the gardens, her books, her pine cones, all are holes in her life. But over these past few weeks, her existence has become tolerable. At least, out on the beaches, Her privation and fears are rinsed away by wind and color and light. Most afternoons, after making the morning rounds with Madame, Marie-Laure sits on her bed with the window open and travels her hands over her father's model of the city. Her fingers pass the shipbuilder's sheds on the Rue de Chartres, past Madame Ruel's bakery on the Rue Robert Surcouf. In her imagination, she hears the bakers sliding about on the flower-slick floor, moving in the way she imagines ice skaters must move, baking loaves in the same 400-year-old oven that Monsieur Ruel's great-great-grandfather used. Her fingers pass the cathedral steps. Here an old man clips roses in a garden. Here, beside the library, crazy Harold Bazin murmurs to himself as he peers with his one eye into an empty wine bottle. Here's the convent. Here's the restaurant Chez Souche beside the fish market. Here's number 4 Rue Vauburel. Its door slightly recessed, where downstairs Madame Manic kneels beside her bed, shoes off, rosary beads slipping through her fingers. A prayer for practically every soul in the city. Here, in a fifth-floor room, Etienne walks beside his empty shelves, trailing his fingers over the places where his radios once stood. And somewhere, beyond the borders of the model, beyond the borders of France, in a place her fingers cannot reach, her father sits in a cell, a dozen of his whittled models on a windowsill, a guard coming toward him with what she wants very badly to believe is a feast. Quail and duck and stewed rabbit, chicken legs and potatoes fried with bacon and apricot tarts. A dozen trays, a dozen platters, as much as he can eat. Nadel im Heuhaufen. Midnight. Dr. Hauptmann's hounds bound through the frozen fields beside the school, drops of quicksilver skittering through the white. Behind them comes Hauptmann in his fur cap, walking with short strides as though counting paces over some great distance. In the rear comes Werner, carrying the pair of transceivers he and Hauptmann have been testing for months. Hauptmann turns, his face bright.
Nice spot here. Good sight lines. Set it down, Fennig. I've sent our friend Folkheimer ahead. He's somewhere on the hill.
Werner sees no tracks, only a humped swale of glitter in the moonlight, and the white forest beyond.
He has the KX transmitter in an ammunition box, Hauptmann says. He is to conceal himself and broadcast steadily until we find him or his battery dies. Even I do not know where he is.
He smacks his gloved hands together, and the dogs swirl around him, their breath smoking. 10 square kilometers. Locate the transmitter. Locate our friend. Werner looks out at the 10,000 snow-mantled trees.
Out there, sir?
Out there. Hauptmann draws a flask from his pocket and unscrews it without looking at it.
This is the fun part, Fennig.
Hauptmann stamps a clearing in the snow, and Werner sets up the first transceiver, uses the measuring tape to pace off 200 meters, and sets up the second. He uncoils the grounding wires, raises the aerials, and switches them on. Already his fingers are numb.
Try 80 meters, Fennig. Typically, teams won't know what band to search for, but for tonight, our first field test, we'll cheat a bit.
Werner puts on the headset and fills his ears with static. He dials up the RF gain, adjusts the filter. Before long, he has tuned in both receivers to Folkheimer's transmitter pinging along.
I have him, sir.
Hauptmann starts smiling in earnest. The dogs caper and sneeze with excitement. From his coat, he produces a grease pencil.
Just do it on the radio. Teams won't always have paper, not in the field.
Werner sketches out the equation on the metal casing of the transceiver and starts plugging in numbers. Hauptmann hands him a slide rule. In 2 minutes, Werner has a vector and a distance, 2.5 kilometers.
And the map?
Hauptmann's little aristocratic face gleams with pleasure. Werner uses a protractor and compass to draw the lines.
Lead on, Fennig.
Werner folds the map into his coat pocket, packs up the transceivers, and carries one in each hand like matching suitcases. Tiny snow crystals sift down through the moonlight. Soon the school and its outbuildings look like toys on the white plain below. The moon slips lower, a half-lidded eye, and the dogs stick close to their master, mouths steaming, and Werner sweats. They drop into a ravine and climb out. 1 kilometer, 2.
Sublimity, Hauptmann says, panting.
You know what that is, Fennig?
He is tipsy, animated, almost prattling. Never has Werner seen him like this.
It's the instant when one thing is about to become something else. Day to night, caterpillar to butterfly, fawn to doe, experiment to result, boy to man.
Far up a third climb, Werner unfolds the map and double-checks his bearings with a compass. Everywhere the silent trees gleam, no tracks save their own. The school lost behind them.
Shall I set out the transceivers again, sir?
Hauptmann puts his fingers to his lips. Werner triangulates again and sees how close they are to his original reading. Under half a kilometer. He repacks the transceivers and picks up his pace. Hunting now. On the scent. All three dogs sensing it too. And Werner thinks,
I have found a way in. I'm solving it. The numbers are becoming real.
And the trees unload siftings of snow, and the dogs freeze and twitch their noses, locked on a scent, pointing as if at a pheasant. And Hauptmann holds up his palm, and finally Werner, coming up through a gap between trees, laboring as he carries the big cases, sees the form of a man lying face up in the snow, transmitter at his feet, antenna rising into the low branches. The giant. The dogs tremble in their stances. Hauptmann keeps his palm up. With the other hand, he unholsters his pistol.
This close, Fennig. You cannot hesitate.
Volkheimer's left side faces them. Werner can see the vapor of his breath rise and disperse. Hauptmann aims his Walther right at Volkheimer, and for a long and startling moment, Werner is certain that his teacher is about to shoot the boy, that they are in grave danger, every single cadet, and that he cannot help but hear Jutta as she stood beside the canal.
Is it right to do something only because everyone else is doing it?
Something in Werner's soul shuts its scaly eyes, and the little professor raises his pistol and fires it into the sky. Volkheimer leaps immediately into a squat, his head coming around as the hounds release toward him, and Werner's heart feels as if it has been blown to pieces in his chest. Volkheimer's arms come up as the dogs charge him, but they know him. They are leaping on him in play, barking and scampering, and Werner watches the huge boy throw off the dogs as if they were house cats. Dr. Hauptmann laughs, his pistol smokes, and he takes a long drink from his flask and passes it to Werner, and Werner puts it to his lips.
He has pleased his professor after all. The transceiver works.
He is out in the luminous, starlit night, feeling the stinging glow of brandy flow into his gut.
This, says Hauptmann, is what we're doing with the triangles.
The dogs circle and duck and romp. Hauptmann relieves himself beneath the trees. Volkheimer trudges towards Werner, lugging the big KX transmitter. He grows ever larger. He rests a huge mittened hand on Werner's cap.
It's only numbers, he says, quietly enough that Hauptmann cannot hear.
Pure math, cadet, adds Werner, mimicking Hauptmann's clipped accent.
He presses his gloved fingertips together, all 5 to 5.
You have to accustom yourself to thinking that way.
It is the first time Werner has heard Volkheimer laugh, and his countenance changes. He becomes less menacing and more like a benevolent, humongous child. More like the person he becomes when he listens to music.
All the next day, the pleasure of his success lingers in Werner's blood, the memory of how it seemed almost holy to him to walk beside Big Folkheimer back to the castle, down the frozen trees, past the rooms of sleeping boys ranked like gold bars in strongrooms. Werner felt an almost fatherly protectiveness for the others as he undressed beside his bunk. As lumbering Folkheimer continued on toward the dormitories of the upperclassmen, an ogre among angels, a keeper crossing a field of gravestones at night. Proposal. Marie-Laure sits in her customary spot at the corner of the kitchen, closest to the fireplace, and listens to the friends of Madame Manic complain. "The price of mackerel," says Madame Fontenon. "You'd think they had to sail to Japan for it." "I cannot remember," says Madame Ebrard, the postmistress, "what a proper plum tastes like." "And these ridiculous shoe ration coupons," says Madame Ruel, the baker's wife. "Theo has number 3,501, and they haven't even called 400. It's not just the brothels on the Rue Thévenard anymore. They're giving all the summer apartments to the freelancers. Big Claude and his wife are getting extra fat. Damned Bosch have their lights on all day. I cannot bear one more night stuck indoors with my husband." Nine of them sit around the square table, knees pressed to knees, ration card restrictions, abysmal puddings, the deteriorating quality of fingernail varnish. These are crimes they feel in their souls. To hear so many of them in a room together confuses and excites Marie-Laure. They are giddy when they should be serious, somber after jokes. Madame Ebrard cries over the non-availability of Demerara sugar. Another woman's complaint about tobacco disintegrates mid-sentence into hysterics about the phenomenal size of the perfumer's backside. They smell of stale bread, of stuffy living rooms crammed with dark, titanic Breton furnishings. Madame Ruel says, "So the Gautier girl wants to get married. The family has to melt all its jewelry to get gold for the wedding ring. The gold gets taxed 30% by occupation authorities. Then the jeweler's work is taxed another 30%. By the time they've paid him, there's no ring left. The exchange rate is a farce. The price of carrots indefensible. Duplicity lies everywhere." Eventually, Madame Manic deadbolts the kitchen door and clears her throat. The women fall quiet. "We're the ones who make their world run," Madame Manic says. "You, Madame Guibou, your son repairs their shoes. Madame Ebrard, you and your daughter sort their mail. And you, Madame Ruel, your bakery makes much of their bread." The air stretches tight. Marie-Laure has the sense that they are watching someone slide onto thin ice or hold a palm over a flame. "What are you saying?" "That we do something. Put bombs in their shoes? Poop in the bread dough?" Brittle laughter. "Nothing so bold as all that. But we could do smaller things. Simpler things."
"Like what?"
"First, I need to know if you're willing." A charged silence ensues. Marie-Laure can feel them all poised there, nine minds swinging slowly around. She thinks of her father. Imprisoned for what? And aches. Two women leave, claiming obligations involving grandchildren. Others tug at their blouses and rattle their chairs as though the temperature in the kitchen has gone up. Six remain. Marie-Laure sits among them, wondering who will cave, who will tattle, who will be the bravest. Who will lie on her back and let her last breath curl up to the ceiling as a curse upon the invaders? You have other friends. "Look out, Pusswood," Martin Burkhard yells as Frederick crosses the quad. "I'm coming for you tonight. He convulses his pelvis maniacally. Someone defecates on Frederick's bunk. Werner hears Folkheimer's voice. Decency does not matter to them.
Bedshitter, spits a boy. Bring me my boots.
Frederick pretends not to hear. Night after night, Werner retreats into Hauptmann's laboratory. 3 times now they have gone out into the snow to track down Folkheimer's transmitter, and each time they have found him more directly. During the most recent field test, Werner managed to set up the transceivers, find the transmission, and plot Folkheimer's location on the map in under 5 minutes. Hauptmann promises trips to Berlin. He unrolls schematics from an electronics factory in Austria and says, "Several ministries have demonstrated enthusiasm for our project." Werner is succeeding. He is being loyal. He is being what everybody agrees is good. And yet every time he wakes and buttons his tunic, he feels he is betraying something. One night, he and Folkheimer trudge back through the slush. Folkheimer carrying the transmitter, both receivers, and the folded antenna under one arm. Werner walks behind, content to be in his shadow. The trees drip. Their branches seem moments away from erupting into bloom. Spring. In 2 more months, Folkheimer will be given his commission and go to war. They stop a moment so Folkheimer can rest, and Werner bends to examine one of the transceivers, draws a little screwdriver from his pocket, and tightens a loose hinge plate. Folkheimer looks down at him with great tenderness. "What you could be," he says. That night, Werner climbs into bed and stares up at the underside of Frederick's mattress. A warm wind blows against the castle, and somewhere a shutter bangs, and snowmelt trickles down the long downspouts. As quietly as he can manage, he whispers, "Are you awake?" Frederick leans over the side of his bunk, and for a moment, in the nearly complete darkness, Werner believes they will finally say to each other what they have not been able to say. "You could go home, you know, to Berlin. Leave this place." Frederick only blinks. "Your mother wouldn't mind. She'd probably like to have you around, Franny too, just for a month, even a week. As soon as you leave, the cadets will let up, and by the time you return, they'll have moved on to someone else. Your father wouldn't even have to know." But Frederick tips back into his bed, and Werner can no longer see him. His voice comes reflecting down from the ceiling. "Maybe it'd be better if we aren't friends anymore, Werner." Too loud. Dangerously loud. "I know it's a liability. Walking with me, eating with me, always folding my clothes and shining my boots and tutoring me. You have your studies to think of." Werner clenches his eyes. A memory of his attic bedroom swamps him. Clicking of mouse feet in the walls, sleet tapping the window. The ceiling so sloped he could stand only in the spot closest to the door, and the feeling that somewhere just behind his vision, ranged like spectators in a gallery, his mother and father and the Frenchman from the radio were all watching him through the rattling window to see what he would do. He sees Jutta's crestfallen face, bent over the pieces of their broken radio. He has the sensation that something huge and empty is about to devour them all. "That's not what I meant," Werner says into his blanket. But Frederick says nothing more, and both boys lie motionless a long time, watching the blue spokes of moonlight rotate through the room. Old Ladies' Resistance Club. Madame Ruel, the baker's wife, a pretty-voiced woman who smells mostly of yeast but also sometimes of face powder or the sweet perfume of sliced apples, straps a stepladder to the roof of her husband's car and drives the Route de Carentan at dusk with Madame Guibou and rearranges road signs with a ratchet set. They return drunk and laughing to the kitchen of No. 4 Rue Vauberel. "Dinan is now 20 kilometers to the north," says Madame Ruel. "Right in the middle of the sea." 3 days later, Madame Fontenot overhears the German garrison commander is allergic to goldenrod. Madame Carré, the florist, tucks great fistfuls of it into an arrangement headed for the chateau. The women funnel a shipment of rayon to the wrong destination. They intentionally misprint a train timetable. Madame Ebrard, the postmistress, slides an important-looking letter from